Okay, the tape is rolling, so here we go. It seems that the first music you really started listening to was contemporary music. What kind of contemporary music first attracted you?
Stravinsky, Debussy, and Ravel, who were contemporary at the time. I, having been born 7 years after Debussy died, I'll let you figure that out. And it was a fluke. The first music that I ever listened to with pleasure or astonishment or envy and sensual reaction was the music of my century and my time. And I feel that my education inadvertently is the right kind of education, and that schools that stress the past and use the present either as punishment or dessert are wrong. And I think it accounts for pretty much of the lopsidedness of the art of music in the public ken today.
Did you find that your interest in contemporary music led you backwards into earlier centuries?
I don't know if you're assuming by that question that I have been led backward into into previous centuries, because in fact, I have as much trouble even today with music of the past as your average listener has with music of the present.
Why do you think that is? Since, you know, amongst people who like classical music, right, or...
I think the reason for that is, and music, by the way, is the only one of the seven lively arts that in which that is the case. It's the only art that is tagging behind the other arts. The other arts, the books we read or that we see advertised, the plays that we go to see are by 9 times out of 10 living playwrights, living authors, movie makers are by definition living. It's only music that... The reason for it, I think, is because music performance and music composing are in two separate camps. And the performer is the big cheese now. And performers are interested in having a public, and the public is interested in that which is familiar. And what is familiar is the past.
Well, I think contemporary music for a lot of people implies that the chords are going to be too dissonant or too challenging, and that the music won't be as melodic.
Well,
and
they don't say that. They don't say that.
Older music.
They don't have that worry about painting, or if they do, they buy it all the same. They don't have that worry about novels, or if they do, they buy them all the same, or about plays, which are horrific, or movies, which are certainly depressing and violent. Why they don't take it in music, I don't know, but because the world seems to revolve around profit and money these days, and contemporary music doesn't reap in the shekels. That's the reason. It's a sad state of affairs.
Do you think that audiences... Were orchestras are any more open to contemporary music than they were when you first started composing?
No, certainly less.
Less so?
It's always been tough on contemporary music, but I would say that, as in the case of publication and recording, the same goes with orchestras, certainly beginning with the Philadelphia Orchestra, that a young composer has very little chance of being heard by the major symphony orchestras, which is why the very nature of contemporary music these days is not geared toward that. Young composers write chamber music, which needs more rehearsal. A big orchestra will say, for financial reasons, they can't afford the amount of rehearsal that contemporary music takes, inferring that all contemporary music is the same, which of course it isn't.
Do you think that American music is sometimes overlooked in favor of European music?
I would say 98% of the time.
Do you have any explanations for that?
Inferiority complex. Mm-hmm. America, we in America may be proud that we can build bigger and better hydrogen bombs and wipe out the world, but we still feel quite meek about our artistic value. Which is why, inexcusably, we hire European conductors for our major symphonies. When that conductor leaves, we replace him with yet another European conductor, and allow these conductors to say there is no such thing as American music, which is a very rude thing to say. And the conductors, like most performers, are interested in their own popularity, and so they play what they think the public wants and what they in turn want too. Managers are also big culprits in this state of affairs. The situation is worse, not better.
Your music is American music. You're from America, but you spent several years abroad, mostly in France. Do you think that listening to your music, there's anything quintessentially American about it?
You would have to define to me what you mean by American music, and then I would say yes or no. Virgil Thompson once defined American music, or how do you write American music? All you have to do is be American, then write whatever kind of music you want. American music is music written by an American. I can't know what impression my music makes on another person, but I do know that when I first went to France, feeling that my instincts were so French and that my music was so sensual and evocative and terse in that rather lewd way that the French have, which so attracted me. Well, I remember when I first played it for Francis Poulenc, whom I felt to be a kindred soul, and waited for compliments, he said, "Why does your music have to be so American, so Protestant, so repressed? Why can't you be more like us?" Nobody ever knows the impression that he's giving.
What do you think are some of the differences between the songs that you write, which would be called art songs, and popular songs?
There's a difference in kind between what, for lack of a better term, one would call a classical song and a pop song. It's a difference in kind or a difference in genus, is that the proper word? Because a pop song can be far more valuable and far more worthwhile than a so-called art song. The difference is this. A pop song is, by its very nature, invariable and based on improvisation. The definition of that is you take a pop song, it can be sung legitimately, fast, slow, high, low, by any sex, with a background of piano or small chamber group or orchestra of 100. Whereas a song, and it can be transposed, whereas a song of, say, Schubert, it is inconceivable that, say, Sarah Vaughan take a song of Schubert, translate it into English, sing it a fifth lower, twice as fast, backed by the Boston Pops. It is not in the nature of that song to be variable. So it's a difference. And as a result, in the evolution of these two kinds of song, there are two kinds of voices that lend themselves to these songs. Linda Ronstadt has proved only this past week that her kind of voice is not meant for La Bohème of Puccini, any more than Elizabeth Schwarzkopf or Tabali, who used to sing La Bohème, could sing the Ronstadt repertory, even though technically they could cut it a lot better than a pop singer can do opera.
Do you sing yourself?
No. Inside every composer lurks a singer trying to get out, and it might even be argued that composers wouldn't even be composers if they weren't frustrated singers. I think that all music worthy of the name, my music's whatever it may be worth, or my reputation seems to center around what I've written for the human voice. But my reasons for having written for the human voice in the first place didn't come from a love of the voice so much as a love of poetry, which was a second only to music. And I wanted to conjoin these two passions, and so I did. It didn't occur to me when I was a teenager that a creature of flesh and blood was going to have to reinterpret these songs. And it wasn't until I was into my 20s that I realized that there were different kinds of singers, like spintos and coloraturas and basso profondos, that had to be pigeonholed into certain areas. But I don't sing.
But do you sing at the piano when you compose a song?
Let me put it this way. I do sing.
But not in public.
There's nothing that daunts me. I can sing anything, but nobody wants to hear me, and they would pay to get me out of the room if I were to sing.
Will you ever sing for demonstration purposes?
I used to until I realized that I was so much sabotaging that which I was trying to demonstrate. I can only think of three examples of composers who could sing: Rinaldo Hahn, Mark Blitzstein and Sam Barber, and Barber had a real voice. The others had sort of fake voices. A lot of pop composers can, like George Gershwin, for example, or can put over their product, as they call it, but they aren't genuine singers. But then, of course, it could be argued that the people who are going to sing their songs aren't genuine singers either in the sense that Maria Callas was.
But you do play piano and...
I'm a good pianist.
Play with singers who perform your mm-hmm. work, mm-hmm. as we're about to hear an example from a record. I'd like to play two songs of yours. Early in the Morning, which is a music set to a poem by Robert Hillier, and I Am Rose, which has a Gertrude Stein poem. Could you talk a little bit about these two songs? Why don't we take them one at a time? Why don't we start with the Hillier, and then come back and we'll talk
about
the Well,
Early in the Morning is a setting I made of Robert Hillier's poem of the same name. I think I wrote it in Munich in 1954, but it's about an American in Paris looking back at his youth. In this performance, I am accompanying Donald Graham, who died only a year ago. Poor boy, he was... It could be argued that he was the most important bass baritone in America in that he had the best diction, the best intelligence, and the widest repertory. And he had a very, very generalized career, both as a recitalist and as an opera singer. And I think I certainly don't have to recite the poem to you because his diction is simply too good. So here he is.
Let's hear it.
Summer day, as they lowered the bright awning at the outdoor cafe, I was breakfasting on croissant and café au lait under greenery like scenery, Rue François Premier. They were hosing the hot pavement with a dash of flashing spray and the smell of summer showers when the dust is drenched away under greenery like scenery, Rue François Premier. I was 20 and a lover, and in paradise to stay. Very early in the morning of a lovely summer day.
Early in the Morning, Ned Rorem at the piano. Donald Graham was the baritone. Let's listen to another one of your songs now, and this is called I Am Rose, and it's music you did to a poem by Gertrude Stein. What attracted you to this poem? It's a very short poem, and it's a very short song.
Well, sometimes one is attracted toward a poem for occasional purposes as well as inspirational purposes, and in this case, the singer... The Polish-French singer Maria Freund was about to have an 80th birthday, and her son asked every composer in the world to write something for her, and he wasn't paying for it, and I wrote this, the shortest poem I could find, which I also thought lent itself to intoned vocal representation, and so I took this... quatrain of Gertrude Stein, which is I am rose, my eyes are blue, I am rose, and who are you? I am rose, and when I sing, I am rose like anything. It's 15 seconds long, and it's my masterpiece. Who is it singing? It's Regina Sarfati, and with me at the Ivories.
I am Rose, and who are you? I am Rose, and when I sing, I am Rose.
That's I Am Rose with text by Gertrude Stein and music by Ned Rorem, who's also featured at the piano. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Ned Rorem. And I should mention that his latest journal, Setting the Tone, has just been published. Do you go around reading poetry expressly to find sources of inspiration for songs?
Yes, I do. I go around reading poetry. I don't read poetry much for the ecstasy of it, the way some people do. I do read prose a great deal. I'm one of the last readers on earth. I read continually. I read 3 or 4 hours a day, I would imagine. And I read novels, and I read 18th and 19th century novels. I'm just finishing Anna Karenina. But I love poetry, and especially I loved it as a kid, but now I don't read it for the love of it. I read it out of duty, either because friends have written it and I'm conned into reading it, or because I'm looking for text. I read it with a rather cold eye now, objective eye.
What does it say, do you think, that you, who are so fiercely 20th century musically, reads 18th and 19th century novels?
Because everybody has the present, but we also have all that past behind us. The people in the past couldn't read the future, and neither can we. I can't spend my time reading novels of the 21st century, obviously. And I think, though, as a composer who does set words to music, left to my own devices, having set everything from Sappho through King David, Shakespeare, Byron, up to the present, left to my own devices now, I would only set music in my words in my native language to contemporary American poets. But that doesn't mean that that's all I want to read.
Some people know you through your music, and others know you through your journals, and not everybody knows you through both. Do you think that you have a different persona that you project through your music than you do through your journals?
Yes, it must be stressed that I am a composer who happens to write, and I'm not an author who happens to be a composer. And the difference is that I make my living as a composer. And that also, as a composer, I always thought of myself as pristine and immaculate and elegant and well-bred and with a slick technique and responsible. And all those years, I used to keep a diary which expressed the Dr. Hyde side of myself, which was mean, snotty, bloody, self-indulgent, hysterical. And when that diary was published, the first volume of it, 1966, and I suddenly realized that total strangers I had never met were going to be reading these things, and that future diaries were going to be published, I suddenly switched roles, and I like to think that my prose became pristine and elegant and immaculate and objective, and my music became a little bit more, let's say, ugly. I think that all great art has to have a strong element of ugliness, by which I don't mean sordidness and lack of control, but like the way a crucifixion or a story of Dostoevsky, or The Rite of Spring, or even some of the sweetest songs of Poulenc have a violence in them. And I would like to think that my music contains that. And my prose, as I write it today, is a good deal less about my own navel, and I hope, and more about things that I feel I'm equipped to talk about, namely the aesthetics and the art scene today.
In your new journal, Setting the Tone, there seems to be a different tone than in the earlier journals. And you write, after a certain age, certain subjects become embarrassingly dull, like sexual intercourse and the injustice of personal sorrow. Do you look back with regret at any of the personal things that you discussed in your earlier journals?
Regret is a word that means you're sorry for what you didn't do. And remorse is to be sorry for what you did do. I would be sorry if I hadn't ever done it, given the occasion, and no, I'm not. When I read some of the prose that I wrote many years ago, I can squirm, but I certainly, in a new edition, don't go around changing words because I don't have the right to. The person that set those, just as the person that wrote the music that I first wrote, after a certain point, you are no longer the author or the composer of that which is out leading its own life for better or worse, and I don't want to contaminate it with the microbes of the present.
In your first memoir, you wrote about...
It's a diary. And there's a very important difference.
That's true. In your first journal, you wrote about being homosexual, and that was at a time that preceded the gay rights movement, when I think very few people felt comfortable entrusting that information to a public, especially a public that included an audience.
I didn't write about being homosexual. I simply didn't disguise the fact. And I think that's important. I am not a flag waver. I don't even think that the word homosexual was in my book at all. But I also think that the subject of homosexuality is not a particularly interesting subject in itself, except in as much as it's political, which now it is. Therefore, I never wrote about the subject of it. If the object of my personal passions or my love life happened to be homosexual, I didn't bother to disguise it. But I don't think I made an issue. And I think that if in any sense I'm to be cited by gay rights movements, which have risen up in the past 10 and 15 years, it's simply not that I made an issue of it, but that I didn't make an issue of it. Is that clear?
Yeah, no, it is clear. But you had that choice of disguising it. You could have just stayed away from that part of your life.
But I also had the choice of not having my journal published in the first place. And a diary format is a very unprecedented literary form in America. It's a standard form in France and in Europe, as a matter of fact, but there are no diaries in America, not any. Even Anaïs Nin, whose book came out at the same time as mine, was European. She was Spanish. So I'm the first diarist in the 20th century. Emerson wrote a diary, after all. And a diary is a diary. And in it, as opposed, say, to a memoir, which is selective and objective and reminiscent, a diary is on-the-spot excesses. Usually a person writes about what is exciting them or depressing them rather than about big issues. That's what my diary was, and it's a very youthful, in a way, thing.
Did it ever affect your career once it was publicly known that you were gay? Did you ever feel you were blacklisted anyway?
Nobody ever knows that. It's very difficult to know, at least in artistic milieu, as opposed, say, if I were selling shirts at Brooks Brothers, what would happen if you would turn this corner instead of that corner. I would say, on the whole, not. Partly because my two careers are so mutually exclusive, and partly because in the world of the professional musician, nobody gives a damn. Or if they do, they're not going to let that stand in the way of if you deliver the goods. Because there is simply, if you eliminated, there's this terribly funny line in Mel Brooks' new movie about gypsies, Jews, and fairies. There wouldn't be any theater if you didn't have them. I especially like the gypsies in there.
Did you ever go through a period in your own life where you thought that homosexuality was some kind of like illness that you should, you know, try to get cured for?
It lasted about 4 days, and that was the end of that. I always thought that, just as I always thought everyone was like me. I have suffered more by the ignorance and ostracization of being a composer, the indifference, than by anything sexual, I think. I always used to think that all the little boys went home after gym class and read Hawthorne and Kafka and wrote music. And to this day, I'm disconcerted by the fact that nobody really cares. or very few people. It's a very aristocratic and society that we live in, the society of the nuance and the finesse of the so-called fine arts.
Well, were you called a sissy by your classmates
for
going home when you were in high school and playing piano instead of going out with the
yes,
guys
I was,
and playing basketball?
Yeah, I was. I certainly was. But rather than let that make me terribly neurotic and make me work very hard, I also knew how I knew my worth. I knew my worth, and I'm still trying to get even with them. When I go back to Chicago now, my high school class, far from ostracizing me, makes me into a sort of a celebrity. And that touches me and, in a sense, vindicates me. But it doesn't mean that I'm in any good. The mere fact that a person suffers in their childhood and is ostracized and is intelligent doesn't mean that they're also a good artist. So I think that, assuming that I am a good artist, that it has nothing to do with anything except that which cannot be defined.
Do you ever get the feeling that some other composers or conductors, performers, would be uncomfortable being seen with you in case someone
no,
would...
No, most definitely
deduce,
not.
You know, I mean, assume that they were
no,
gay too?
Mm-hmm. No.
How did you relate to the gay pride movement when it got established?
I wasn't especially interested. It was already involved people younger than I and who were born... By the same token, they were born at a time when they couldn't remember the world without the atom bomb in it. Young people today don't know what it's like to live in a period that is not literally threatened. In the past, we were metaphorically threatened by the end of the universe. If we were evil, we would go and burn in hell forever. Now, in fact, we will. The gay rights movement, like any radical movement, and it's not so radical any longer, but about 10 years or so ago, like the women's movement and like the black movement, any radical movement of a minority or an oppressed majority, as in the case of women, is going to lose its humor right off the bat. It has to, by definition. You put on blinders and you can see not to the right or left with impunity. You have to look straight ahead and go where you're going. And therefore, it's never very witty and it's never very much fun, but it gets a lot done. I wrote, for example, about 10 years ago, and I said, here I live, and I published this at the New Republic, here I live in the heart of the 23rd zip code area of New York City, which has more creative and interpretive artists than any place in the world since Paris in the 20s, and Bella Abzug, who is the representative of this area, has never lifted her finger toward the arts. Now, that was not a criticism of Bella Abzug. Immediately, some secretary wrote a letter to the New Republic and said, that isn't true at all. Ms. Abzug just last week was at a cocktail party for the Metropolitan Opera or something equally innocuous. My point was that she doesn't have time in her zeal, which I think is or thought was infinitely commendable, for the arts. And the arts, and I'm primarily an artist and not a revolutionary. And an artist, by definition, sees all sides of a coin and sees all three sides of the coin, let's put it, whereas a revolutionary can only afford to see one.
Because they don't want to get distracted from their course.
Precisely. You can't. That's why the black movement suddenly, black is beautiful. Well, black isn't beautiful. Neither is it ugly. Gay is not good, but neither is it bad. I think it's, as I'm sure you do too, and as I said earlier, if it were not a political issue, it would not be interesting any more than heterosexuality in itself has any interest at all. And neither does being black is that interesting, except insofar as a black person suffers from being black, and therefore we need a better world. Once we had that world, we could get onto important things like stopping wars. Homosexuality is so unimportant.
Did it change your image of homosexuality to live in Europe for a decade? Did it mean something different in Europe than it meant in America?
France is the least inverted country on the planet, if one can say such things, and that's where I lived. It's very difficult to say how one have would have been if one had done this or that. I was 10 years older after I spent 10 years in France. So how can I answer that? Nobody can.
Okay. My guest is composer Ned Rorem, who's also written three journals. His latest, Setting the Tone, has just been published. Let me quote a couple of things from the new journal, Setting the Tone. You say, "I often think about how seldom I think of sex." And you write, "Well, at least I'm free of being in love, the wasted months of being in love." And you're not talking there about loving somebody, but of like a new passionate romance at the very beginning. Did you find passions like that inspiration for your music or distraction from your music?
A young person, whether he is a composer or whether he, or whatever he does, is by definition occupied with other than professional matters at hand. I mean, a young person is interested in love, as he is interested in food and travel, and can do all kinds of things without paying a lot of money for it. He can go around the world and stay in youth hostels. Anybody, as he gets older, is going to give himself priorities, just as anybody. I don't drink anymore on the principle that anybody can get drunk, but only I can write my music, and if I don't, nobody else is going to do it. And why am I going to let my life wither away as I lie in bed moaning with my hangover? By the same token, I've thought about the business of inspiration in relation to one's private life. The best inspiration, I think that any genuine or artist will tell you that the best inspiration has nothing to do with love affairs or looking at beautiful pictures. It has to do with four walls and no window, and the time to get your work done, to be away from the distractions. Even experience has nothing to do much with writing a very perceptive book, let alone writing a symphony. It seems to be sort of second-rate or journalistic kind of minds, not that the two are the same at all, that think you have to have a great deal of experience and you have to fall in love and you have to smoke pot and you have to do this and that in order to be an artist. Well, it simply is demonstrably untrue. To be an artist means to, among other things, objectify and to render communicable that which moves you. It doesn't have to be big scope, but it has to be put into notes or oil or nouns in such a way that it's not just a lot of blather, inspired blather, but chiseled, communicable ectoplasm, if you will, that will float from the artist into the world. I'm struggling for words, but no, I don't see any relation. And I've never I think that one can prove with novels or things that deal with a common language that a person's experience has a great deal to do with what they choose to stress in their writing. But with music, if you write on commission, you can write a sad piece or a happy piece. If I'm writing a sad piece, who is to define whether it's sad or not? And assuming that we all agree on what sadness means in music, do I write that piece out of my present sadness or out of what I know about sadness? And I think the answer is the second question. If you are actually sad, you can't write music with tears in your eyes because they will fall on the paper and blur the ink. Therefore, I've always thought the artists in the long run are, even bad ones, are the happiest people in the world insofar as while they are in the act of working, they don't have these conflicts. They can come out of their studio and burst into tears or be madly happy, but while they're in there, they are in sort of a floating limbo of self-discipline. And they don't suffer at that time. Even physical pain can go away while you're working.
I'm going to quote something else from your journal, Setting the Tone. You write, "Ecstasy in the sense of unbridled self-expression no longer governed me after age 30. Was that intentional? I mean, did you say, I have to leave some of this behind and spend more time on my work? Or did it just end up that way that when you reached a certain age, you're...
Did I say that?
Interesting, yeah.
If I said that, I think I would even take it back earlier to about age 20. And I might go so far as to say this, that I don't think any artist, even the greatest artist in the world, have more than four or five ideas in their whole life. And I think that they've got those ideas by the time they leave adolescence, let's say 15 or 16. By the time one is that age, one has experienced most of what there is to experience in the way of sadness and joy and observation of the suffering, the horrors, and the beauties of the world. You spend the rest of your life trying to sort that out, make sense of it. And it's the sorting out and the making sense which produces a work of art or even a integrated person. Doesn't have to be art. We are either have your maximum intelligence by an early age or you don't.
You used to drink a lot. I know you don't drink
yes.
anymore. And in the Paris Diary, you wrote, "I've spent one third of my life in sleep, one third in drink, and one third vomiting," which is, I'm sure, not really true.
It's not true, but it's true in a symbolic way.
What?
I think that I am alcoholic, and like anybody who is alcoholic knows that the answer for that is you don't drink. Drinking in moderation is, if you can drink in moderation, you're not an alcoholic, period. And that's too well known a fact in AA, for example, to be disputed, except by doctors who'd never know anything about anything anyway. And as I said earlier, I reached that conclusion, and if this is of any help to people who are listening, just remember that anybody can drink. There's nothing original, and there's nothing interesting about it. Nobody likes you when you do it. I don't care whether you're Beethoven or the checkout girl at the A&P, you're a bore. But I'm infinitely sympathetic to the fact that it is beyond your control to do it in a sensible way that doesn't, in the long run and sometimes in the short run, bring very serious sorrow and ultimately suicide in either literal or figurative. So stop. And there are a lot of people out there who will help you.
What got you to stop?
I have a strong streak of self-preservation, very strong. And because I have a great faith in my talents, I stopped partly with a little help from some of my friends and from AA, but mainly because I feel that I am unique, as everybody is unique. And there is no problem that can be solved by getting drunk over it. None. Not even starvation or financial worries or love. It can only become worse.
I know a lot of artists feel that drinking or smoking marijuana or taking some kind of drug helps free inhibitions and helps get in touch with inspiration. Did you feel that way when you were drinking?
Well, you say you know a lot of artists, but I defy you to mention an artist over the age of 35 who is a creative artist as opposed, say, to a jazz musician who is an interpretive, rather, or a performing artist. I defy you to tell me of one that you really, whose work you really respect, who seriously believes that. A Henry James or a Tolstoy or a Stravinsky. There might be artists who have too much to drink from time to time, but to do that with any regularity, and Coleridge would be the first person to tell you that there are too many lousy Hollywood movies that have fired that false impression, but it just ain't true. Most artists are more interested in their work, as a matter of fact, than they are in work can be such a drug itself that these what Baudelaire called artificial paradises of LSD and so on. The thing about that is it makes you think you're a great artist. And when you look at what you've done under the influence of alcohol, you say, oh, my God, am I really that bad rather than that good? But while you're doing it, you think you're God.
Did you have to change the circle of friends you traveled with when you stopped drinking
yes.
so as to not
yeah.
be around
oh,
alcohol?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Mainly you realize how boring people are when they're drunk, and you know how boring you yourself can be while drunk. We're certainly stressing a lot of alcoholism and sex, and but I suppose that's okay. Yeah, you do. You automatically don't go to parties that you know you're going to be bored at. And also, I'm very shy. I think I drank a great deal because I out of shyness, and it makes you think, makes you less shy. But so I'm shy. It's so big deal.
Can you hear the difference in your work before and after? Is there anything as
no,
well as
no, that? No. But I didn't, when I used to write music at the time, I wrote at the time that I was drinking, but never while drunk. I do everything to excess. Therefore, I am sober to excess. And during moments of sobriety, I worked very, very hard. Worked. I hope it's in the past tense.
Your latest journal, Setting the Tone, was recently published. And about a year ago, I think, your two previous journals were republished.
Yes.
Did you take that opportunity to go back and read them?
Well, I had to go back and read the Paris Diary, the New York Diary, and the so-called later diaries, which are so prettily reprinted by North Point, because they did a new edition. They reset the plates, and I did, and I said, oh, I admired a great deal of it, and a great deal of it I was very disconcerted by, but I read it as though another person had written it, and there were certain things that this other person had written that embarrassed me and offended me, but I felt that I did not have the right to edit. You can't do it.
Do you still keep journals now?
I keep a journal, but with a very different point of view. I don't sit down and write, "Be still, O my heart." I make notes that I will later develop in journalist in diary form about various human or artistic situations that I think that I will elaborate on, and I'll write down a lot of epigrams and such.
Do you use any self-censorship knowing that these will probably
definitely
be published? Yeah. Do friends, when they call you up, ask you to please leave them out of your journal?
When the Paris Diary came out, I think I may have lost some friends. It never occurred to me, because I hear I'd been writing music for ages. Nobody ever puts anyone in jail for writing music or for having subversive thoughts or being obscene. It never occurred to me that people would object to two or three words or lines. But it's true. When I see myself written about in prose, even when it's very favorable, I always say, "Well, why did they write this and not that?" Why does my mother compliment me on this necktie that she gave me instead of saying I should have worn the other one? People reading about themselves, no matter who they are always disconcerted. Even listening, if I ever do, to this discussion I'm having with you now, later, I'll say, why didn't I say this instead of that? Or why didn't Terry Gross ask me this instead of that question? Nobody likes to see themselves boiled down to, or I'll be horrified by the tone of voice I have, or something.
Well, it's funny that you should say nobody is comfortable being written about or is comfortable with what they've said once they've said it. And you're really on two sides of the fence on that one, in the sense that you are a composer whose work is written about critically, and you're a music critic as well, who writes about other people's
music. Yeah, that's rather un-American, because in America, for economic reasons, people have always been specialists because they could afford to be, so that a doctor of the left foot never looks at the right foot, let alone your ears, nor does he. Whereas in Europe, not only does a composer write every kind of music for the movies, for ballet, for opera, for symphony, for Edith Piaf or for Maria Callas, but that composer will also hobnob with statesmen, doctors, the professions intermix. They still don't much in America. And here I have two professions, and literary people really don't know anything about music for the most part. Very accomplished literary people are not. Many of them don't need music at all and don't know what I'm talking about if I talk about music. So, yes, I lead this schizophrenic coexistence.
Do you think for someone to truly understand your music, they should read your journals too?
I can't really answer that question. I can't answer that. What do you think?
I don't know.
I think people are often when people sometimes come and talk to me about this or that, they'll say, "You said such and such about this piece of music," and I'll forget that I've said it. Or, "How do you justify your attitude musically to this when you've written this in prose?" I really feel quite split down the middle. I think that biographers are by definition wrong in what they write about their subject, because you cannot put into words that which another person is. There's nothing I can say about my own music, even as I talk to you, that the music can't say a thousand times better. And there's nothing I can say about my books the books don't say better.
Yet you write critically about other people's music, and yeah, with their music you believe that there is stuff that...
Yeah, but I can't do that. I never speak critically about my own music, and I never, when I expound or write program notes of my own music, I never write anything except either gossip or how it came to be. I'm not interested in composers who have theories about their own music or tell you about the construction of it, because the music itself can tell you that thing. But I like to know what they had for breakfast when they began it, or things of that sort, the circumstances.
Do you think that music critics should, like you, have some background in music to be either a composer or a performer?
I don't know whether they should, which has a sort of a moral connotation to it, but I think it's demonstrable that the best critics, all three of them in the world...
Who are you including?
Robert Schumann, Debussy, Virgil Thompson, and myself have all been composers. And I think that I think that the only people who have a right, in a way, to be critics are people who are speaking from the inside out somehow. There are a lot of very readable, interesting critics. In the book world, it wasn't true 15 years ago, but today it's true that the best critics are all writers. But the leading music critics, note I don't say the best, but the leading music critics are none of them composers or even executive performers. Not one of them. You mentioned you're having John Rockwell in a day or two. I don't know that he plays any instrument. He certainly doesn't have time for any career but what he's doing. Andrew Porter. It was the policy of Virgil Thompson, and he was the chief critic on the Herald Tribune, to hire only people who were practicing musicians. It's the policy of the New York Times to, if a person is discovered to be a practicing musician or even a teacher of music, he's fired. And that is why the collective music literature that has come out of the Times, all trillion words of it in the past three decades, is not memorable.
It's interesting to me that your religious background is Quaker.
Yes.
And that's one of the few religions, or perhaps the only religion I can think of, in which music doesn't really play a part.
It could be. It's conceivable that because I am a Quaker, that is to say, raised in a WASP, middle class, middle Western background, I never even knew what... My parents were intelligent, cultured, still are people, but I never knew what sour cream or garlic or pastrami were till I moved to New York. We had special Goyish meals, and... The carnality of Mediterranean art didn't enter into the picture. And as soon as I was exposed to that kind of music, note that I think the whole universe can be divided between French and German aesthetically. Assuming that it can, that everything, the walls of this room, these microphones, not to mention all art or dogs and cats, everything can be divided between French or German aesthetically. Assuming that's the case, I fall roundly into French. I've always been very attracted toward things Catholic, toward things ritualistic, toward things Mediterranean. Maybe I wouldn't have been if I'd been exposed to that as a child. I'm a good Quaker to this day, but I never go to meeting. I don't think that the fact that I went against typecasting made me any good. I think the kind of music I write has to do with my background, but as to whether that music is good or isn't any good is beyond anybody's control. I think you can explain a person's art according to his economic background and his religious background, but I don't think that you can explain But whether it's good or bad. You can explain his format or what he's attracted to. Even that's a pretty big generality, of course. Incidentally, as a Quaker and raised therefore in silence, I needed noise, but I wanted organized noise. I wrote a piece 10 years ago for organ solo in 12 movements, great big fat 40-minute suite called A Quaker Reader. And since Quakers have no music by definition, it's not that they were puritanical. They weren't. They simply felt that music distracted. They had music when they got home at night and danced and sang and things. But I used epigraphs from Quaker writers, from George Fox through up to Jessamine West, as titles for each of these movements, and I used them as inspiration, if you will, toward the various sections of this piece.
We only have about a minute left. Mm. When you're home at night or during the day, do you ever put music on and listen to records?
I certainly did listen insanely to music by 100 hours a day when I was a kid. I do it a good deal less these days because I'm more immersed in the silence of my own music. Love, Ned.
Okay, thank you.